This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
1400 years ago, over 1400 years ago, we believe as Muslims that the Creator, by the angel Gabriel, said the following words to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, upon whom be peace. Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. Read, recite. Read, recite in the name of your Lord who created. Brothers, sisters and friends, these were the first few words that had a profound, dramatic impact not only in 7th century Arabia, but on the entire world. Because these first few words were the words that actually shook humanity. It shook the world. Because these words, not only profound in meaning, but these words provided the basis for an entirely new literary form. The way these words were expressed in such a way that no one until this day has been able to emulate or imitate the literary form of the Quranic discourse. This is why the popular historian Karen Armstrong, she says that if it wasn't for this new, entirely new, different literary form, Islam would never have taken root. Because it was the impact of the language that changed everything. But I'm going to talk about this a little later. So these few words, brothers and sisters, changed the world. Not only did it change the way we look at the Arabic language, but it changed society, it changed politics, it changed economics, it changed the way we look at God Himself. And it is no wonder Eastern and Western scholarship, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, makes no difference here. There's almost a conclusion or a consensus that the Quran has been described as a very imposing text, a very intrusive text. It has force. Now this force, this intrusion, this imposition is not a negative one, brothers and sisters. Rather, it's entirely positive. Because it seeks to positively engage with the inner dimensions of man, with the inner dimensions of the human being. It wants to positively engage with your aql, in Arabic meaning intellect. It wants to positively engage with your nafsiyah, with your internal psychological disposition, with your soul. This is why many of the historical and contemporary exegetes of the Quran, those who explain the Quran, they describe the Quran like a hand. That it goes into someone's soul and gives it a good shake. Wake up. There is a reality. It's God. He's one. You're going to be accountable. You're not here just for mere play. So the Quran seeks to engage with the inner dimensions of man. So how does the Quran achieve this, people? How does the Quran achieve this amazing strategy of engaging with your heart and your mind? Well, the way the Quran does this is by asking profound questions, people. Profound questions. وَفِي أَنفُسِكُمْ أَفَلَا تُبْصِرُونَ. And in themselves, do they not see? أَفَلَا يَنظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبِلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ. Have you not seen the camel? Creation. And how it was created. أَوَلَمْ يَتَفَكَّرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ. And do they not reflect within themselves? Referring to the physiological and psychological dynamic of the human being. Because we are an undiscovered universe. We are an undiscovered universe, brothers and sisters. So the Quran engages you so you can think deeply about these realities. It is no wonder the Quran concludes, وَكَذَلِكَ نُفَصِّلُ الْآيَاتِ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. And thus do we explain our signs, our evidences in detail for those يتفكرون, for those who reflect. This word in the Arabic language comes from the Arabic triliteral stem fa-ka-ra. And according to the classical dictionaries of Arabic, it indicates something very profound. It means that the thing that you're reflecting upon, you must inquire deeply about its implications. What does it mean that there's a beginning to the universe? What does it mean that I have a consciousness? What does it mean that there is design in the universe? What does it mean that I have this innate disposition to sanctify things, which Muslims would call the worship instinct, the fitrah, the innate disposition to acknowledge the divine? This is what this word means. The triliteral stem, fa, ka, ra. That the thing that you're reflecting upon, you must inquire deeply about its implications. Don't be a desert romantic. Don't smoke your shisha and touch the sand and look at the stars and write poetry to your beloved. Rather, the thing that you're reflecting upon, the object of meditation, think deeply about it. Particularly its consequences. So the Quran, from this perspective, is a very dynamic book because it does seek to engage intellectually and emotionally. And it does seek to evoke thinking, to create that awareness within man. Because if you think about it, brothers and sisters, the 21st century is a century of scientific progress, but not thinking. Bold statement. The 21st century is a century of progressive materialism, but not progressive thought. We've regressed in thought. If you look at some of the children, just one century ago, a few hundred years ago, you would see these children, they would read the works of Homer. Homer's Iliad, classical Greek that was the formation of the Greek language. There's three types of Greek. There's like pre-classical, classical, and post-classical, if you like. And this Greek is a very hard Greek. There were farmers in America that would just be peasant farmers, and while they're resting in the blazing sun, they'll take out of the pocket an ancient Greek story by Homer. I just have a little read. But today, we don't do that anymore. We don't think anymore. Why? Because we have immersive environments. The iPhone, the Xbox, the iPad, which is a ridiculous convention because it's in between an iPhone and a laptop. You didn't even need it in the first place. Consumerism has you. It's changed you. I bet some of you who have an iPad think that I couldn't live without it. That's the nature of consumerism, isn't it? It says, you have too many needs, and I know what these are. And by the way, I have a product for you. This is why Professor Coran, ironically, of Maryland University states that basically that in a capitalist consumerist society, we, the consumer, has to bail out the government by just buying more stuff. So greed is essential in this type of society. That's another topic anyway. But the point I'm trying to say is we have immersive environments. Why? Because we suffer from something called self-annihilationism, self-destruction, because we don't like who we are. That's why we want these immersive environments. This is why we take drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol is a phenomenon that aligns itself with self-annihilationism. Read the psychology, because they don't like their sense of self. They don't like the sober me. I want to be the drunk me, or the drugged up me. It's such a better me. Because I'm not confident when I don't have these things. And I don't really know who I am when I don't have these things. It is I have this illusion of a sense of self as a result of these immersive environments. That's not only drugs and alcohol, it's also strategy games. Who's played Cossacks before? Anyone? No one knows about Cossacks? You drive people. But Cossack is an old strategy game I used to play. I used to work for the police IT organization as a project manager many years ago before it got disbanded. And the senior police officers used to play this strategy game called Cossacks, which is basically you start with peasants, you get mining, you get gold and coal, and you create big buildings and armies and you take over the world. Okay? But you have to have a strategic mind. I'm telling you, sometimes when I put that CD into the PC. Well, yeah, the PC at the time. I would start at 10 in the morning, and then I'd look at my watch, and next minute, you know, it's 7 p.m. But you have that with Xbox sometimes. Who plays Xbox? Don't lie. Oh, well done, sister. Xbox. It's like an immersive environment. You can be there for hours. Yeah? Because you don't like your life, you don't like your sense of self. You suspend the thinking that allows you to think about man, life, and the universe. You suspend the critical questions. And this is why I think the Quran is a 21st century book, because it tells you and makes you reevaluate your life. Where are you? Who are you? Where are you going? Whose are you? Why are you? And these are profound questions, because the Quran, from this perspective, is a very existential text. It talks to you as a human being. It talks to you and tries to make you discover your sense of self. This is why it says about the Quraysh, the Arabs of the time, are you going to follow your forefathers? Social conditioning, biological conditioning, political conditioning, even though they were baseless, it was based on falsehood. That's a profound statement from a religious book, because it's making you transcend social, economic, and biological slavery. Because it is slavery. Just like the American writer once wrote, that being born is like being kidnapped and sold to slavery. Because there's no such a thing as freedom, people. Why am I not free to wear my hijab? No, you know, God said it, so shut up. I don't know why we fall for that liberal narrative sometimes, yeah? Oh, it's my choice. Yeah? Imagine saying to that on the Day of Judgment. It was my choice to go to school with a bikini. I mean, not that people do, but imagine. But the point I'm trying to say is that there is no absolute freedom from that perspective. There is no absolute freedom. Why? Because you didn't even choose your race. You didn't choose your eye color. You didn't choose your gender. You didn't choose your parents. You never chose your siblings. You didn't choose the social economic background, circumstance, context. You never chose any of these things, people. And you're saying that you're free? Are we crazy? This is delusional. This is what the post-Enlightenment philosophers called the existentialists, like Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Kierkegaard, or Heidegger. They had a constant thrownness, that you're thrown into reality, and you're slave to that context. To deal with it, to act responsibly, you shouldn't react to it, but respond to it positively. And this is why we're slaves. We're either slave to our social biological context, or we're a slave to our own egos, the sense of the lower self. And this is why the Quran brings a new narrative. It says, look, you're a slave anyway. You're always going to be a slave. But how are you going to be an enlightened slave? And the Quran asserts that being a servant to Allah, a slave to Allah, a slave to God, having ubudiyyah, servanthood to Allah, you free yourselves from the slavery of your social biological context and the slavery of your own desires. That's the reality of a Muslim. Should be the reality of a Muslim. That we choose our slavery. I'm not going to be a slave to the system. Am I just a product of consumer society? Am I just a product of my DNA? Is that it? Is that who I am? Just a biological robot typing the code and there's me? No. Because I know something intuitive. There's something different and distinct and unique about moi. Yeah? Isn't there? I might even be slave to my own desires. The passions, as the Greek philosophers would say. Are you a slave to your passions? Just to eat and eat. And to consume. And to have this kind of instinct of survival all the time. Or procreation for many people. Are we just a slave to these things? Or are we going to transcend this slavery and really free ourselves from these things by worshipping God? This is why God says in the Quran that He created mankind إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ, except for His worship. And worship, we know in the Quranic discourse, is a comprehensive term. It doesn't mean headbutting the floor 5 times a day. It's a worldview. Worship for us is having good economic transactions, smiling at your brother. Worship for us it's so comprehensive, it even includes ensuring that your spouse has physical and emotional satisfaction. But you didn't know that, people. Imagine your Pakistani uncle saying that to you.
Tawbah. What do you Pakistanis do? I don't know, you do some funky stuff sometimes.
I said funky.
Yeah? So,
you know, worship is comprehensive. Even from this perspective, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, told his companions, male and female, that he forbade the husband or the wife to engage physically, with their partner. He forbade them to engage physically with their partner if they didn't engage in foreplay first. You didn't know that, did you, by the Prophet? He's a 21st century man. He's a timeless man. These are the teachings that we should know. There's no taboo in these subjects. Why should there be? But the point, the reason I bring these examples, because you're young, and I know I get you excited, and you listen to me further, it's a psychological ploy. But the other reason I mention these things is to show that worship is very comprehensive. So, the Quran freed man by making him think, and make him free himself from the slavery of social, biological, and political context. But the Quran shook the world even further, not in terms of making people think, but also it challenged the whole of mankind with regard to its authorship. Something very unlikely for a book. A religious book, 1400 years old, based in the 7th century, coming out with such a challenge. Impossible. But it did. In the second chapter, Surah Baqarah, verse 23, the Quran announces, وَإِن كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبِ مِمَّا نَزَلْنَا عَلَىٰ عَبْدِنَا فَأْتُوا بِسُورَةٍ مِنْ مِثْلِهِ وَدَعُوا شُهَدَاءَكُمْ مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. And if you are in doubt, that's what the Quran is saying. If you doubt, we live in an age of skepticism, an age of doubt. If you doubt this book, which we have sent down to our servant, referring to the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, then bring one chapter like it. A single chapter, people. It's only 3 lines long. The smallest chapter. Bring a single chapter if you are truthful in your claim. Now this relates to the inimitability of the Quranic discourse, which means the Quran cannot be matched. And there are various reasons for this. And I'm going to articulate some of these reasons. Let me first and foremost give you a background to the Quran. The Quran was revealed 14 centuries ago. The Quran was revealed over a period of time, a 23-year period. And many of its verses were revealed for specific times and specific places. Don't get me wrong, many of the verses are general, which apply to various contexts. But also, some of the verses were revealed for specific times and places. But what's very unique is that the Quran was formed into chapters. And these chapters are literary and numerically coherent. If that's the case, then how are they coherent if they were revealed over a 23-year period? It only indicates that the author knew the future. Because some chapters, the conclusion was written in the beginning. Then they went into the introduction. They start writing a little bit of the main part. Then they went back to the conclusion. Imagine starting an essay by starting with your conclusion, then going to the introduction, into the middle, then back into the introduction, then going to the conclusion again. You won't have an essay, you'll have gibberish. Or in the Urdu language, you'll have bakwas. Yeah? Lot of rubbish. Bakbak. Yeah? It's rubbish. So, the point is, brothers and sisters, and friends, if the Quran is coherent from this perspective, then surely, how can it come from a human being? That raises a question that's a signpost to the divine. Let me give an example. The second chapter of the Quran, Surah Baqarah, is 286 verses long. It was revealed over a 9-year period, and if you were to chop that chapter in the middle, you'd have the 143rd verse. And within that verse, what word do you find? Middle. You find the word middle. Also, the Quran mentions the word seven heavens. And that word is repeated 7 times. You have the words for hell and heaven mentioned exactly the same times. You have the words for dunya, which means the world, and akhirah, which means the hereafter, mentioned exactly the same times. Now we've checked this out in Cassis Concordance. It's 1500 pages long. What's interesting is in the 3rd chapter, the Quran says, the likeness of Jesus in the eyes of God is the same as Adam. Is the same as the likeness of Adam. And Jesus and Adam are both mentioned 25 times each in the Quran. Significantly, up to this verse, they're both mentioned 7 times each. There is a unique numerical consonance within the Quran. How can we explain this when the Quran is written over a 23-year period for specific times and places and formed together to develop chapters that were literally coherent, but also have this established numerical coherence also? This shows it's a signpost to the divine. It's a signpost to the divine. So there's the numerical coherence for you. Another argument that shows that the Quran is a signpost to the divine, a sign to the transcendent, it's its view in history. Now the Quran is an amazing philosophy on history. It says don't just record history, but reflect upon history. Look at the past nations. Think about their reality. If we do look into history, we see every tyrant has dropped on the floor. Every tyrant, from his throne, he has been dethroned. It's quite surprising that we have tyrants today. Haven't they learned from the past? Haven't they learned from the Pharaoh, the story of the Pharaoh and Moses? But that's arrogance for you. So the Quran makes us think about history in a profound way so we can look into it to learn stories, to learn examples, and to learn patterns in our history so we don't fall for the same mistakes, we don't fall for the same traps, we don't fall for the same obstacles that come in our way as the human species. But interestingly, the Quran also mentions history that's almost irrelevant. If you were to take it out, it won't make no difference to the book. Now what am I talking about? I'm talking about the reference or the label or the title of the leader of the Egyptians. And the Quran, when it refers to Moses, Musa alayhi salam, mentions the title of the Egyptians as Fir'aun, Pharaoh, which is fair enough. There's nothing special about that. By the time of Joseph, which you can find in the 12th chapter, which is called the chapter Joseph, in the 12th chapter, when it talks about Joseph, it mentions the leader of the Egyptians as Malik, king. Why is there differentiation between the leader of the Egyptians at the time of Joseph and the leader of the Egyptians at the time of Moses? All other religious traditions like the Bible and the Torah, which existed at that time, never mentioned Malik, always mentioned Fir'aun, Pharaoh. So why is there this difference? Was the Quran wrong? Because we know Moses was at the time of the New Kingdom, and Yusuf was at the time of the Old Middle Kingdom. But it took us up to the 19th century to find out what was going on. Because hieroglyphs was a dead language. The Egyptian pictorial language was a dead language at that time. But when we found the Rosetta Stone, which allowed us to translate from hieroglyphs into Greek and therefore into other languages, we could go into Egyptian history. And we find that the reference to Pharaoh started happening at the time of Moses. And at the time of Joseph, it was the leader of the Egyptian was always mentioned as king. Such a minute historical detail. Where did the Prophet, upon him be peace, get this information? Where did he get this information from? He could have copied it from the Bible because the Bible just mentioned Pharaoh. Hieroglyphs was a dead language at the time. The historians at the time never mentioned this. So what was it? A lucky guess? Something to think about. So that's the historical perspective. I'm going to mention many aspects of the Quran. So we're going through numerical consonants, historical perspective, natural phenomena, linguistics, message. So we're going to have a dynamic view on the Quran today. So the next point is, let's talk about natural phenomena. Now you may have heard, or you may have read, that there are scientific miracles in the Quran. I disagree with this. Sorry guys. Because by saying it's a scientific miracle, it assumes the Quran predates science. It doesn't. Because you always have to have a retrospective analysis on the Quranic discourse. You have to go and understand the science now at the time in order to try and relate it to the Quran. It's not the other way around. So we have to have a balanced view. We can't just say the Quran is a scientific miracle. Well, how do you know? You have to know the science of today in order to know that. Right? So it's retrospective. But since the Quran is a 7th century product, according to some, it should represent 7th century realities, but it doesn't. And this is why it's quite special, because the Quran always agrees with established fact. Not scientific proof, because that changes. But established fact, which I call what we know of natural phenomena, what we know to be true. Something objective, not theories like Big Bang cosmology, but actually something that's really objective. Can we see it? Is it binary? It's either 0 or 1. That type of fact. And interestingly, the Quran is not a reflection of the 7th century understanding of natural phenomena. This is why Professor or Sheikh Muhar Ali, in his book The Quran and the Orientalist, says the Quran is not contingent on the 7th century understanding of reality. And to give you an example of this, I'm going to talk about Surah Mu'minun, chapter 23, verses 12 to 15. And that's chapter 23, verses 12 to 15. Now, Surah Mu'minun elucidates and highlights the development of the human embryo. Okay? The development of the human embryo. And it gives various terms to justify this. And these are the terms, okay? You have nutfa. Then you have qararin makin. Then you have alaqa. Then you have mudgha. I'm going to explain this for you. Then you have idham. Then you have the process of fecasona. And then you have lahma. These are essential to understand, okay? Very simple terms in the Quran. Let me just break them down for you. Now the Quran mentions nutfa. Nutfa, according to Lisan al-Arab, which is a classical dictionary, refers to a sperm drop, or semen, or drop of fluid, or single pearl, or a drop from a bigger group of its kind. A drop of water left in a bucket from a bigger volume of water. Also, nutfa can mean, from a Quranic perspective, something that's mixed from two other single substances. Because the Quran elsewhere mentions that the nutfa can be a mixed substance from two other substances. And we know, according to the prophetic traditions, this elucidates something from the female and the male. The male and the female. Indicating that the male has a sperm drop, and so does a female equivalent, which we call the egg. Also, the word nutfa is not a synonym for semen. It's coming from the semen. So it's a specific drop from the semen, because in the Quran it says nutfatin min maniyin, meaning the nutfa is from the mani, the maniyin, the semen itself. Okay? Also, the Quran says sulala. It's an extract. The word sulala means something pure or an essential element from it. So think about this. The word nutfa is not just semen. It's a specific drop from semen coming from the male and female with an extract within it, with something specific within it. When I describe this to you, what do you think of? Sperm, right? On egg. We never had this understanding in 7th century Arabia. We only knew about the sperm in the 17th century. This is quite phenomenal. But it's something we could discuss later. So it looks what relates to modern embryology. If you read the works of John Allen and Beverly Kramer, or Ram Sharma, which are modern embryologists, the books are available in Borders, normal text, normal medical textbooks, they talk about the process of fertilization. And the process of fertilization is, you need a single sperm and a single egg to come together. And it forms the zygote. And significantly, since this also means a specific drop, indicating a physiological process, that it requires fluids. And we know the sperm has to be contained in semen in order to have effective fertilization. And recently, if you read Bruce Stanton's physiology book, the egg has to be coated in ovoductal secretions. So that has its drop as well. It has its fluid as well. So the Quran correlates. I'm not saying it's 100% specific and defined, but it's not wrong. Then it goes and says, قرار المكين, which means to affirm, to establish, to make sedentary, which relates to the process of implantation. Because after the 6 or 7 day of fertilization, you have the process of implantation, where from the zygote, it forms into a blastocyst. And the blastocyst is where the cells divide a little bit more, and there's an outer wall. And the blastocyst sinks deeper and deeper into the uterine wall. It sinks deeper, and when it gets encased by a fibrin clot. And many of the embryologists, like Ram Sharma, for instance, and Beverly Kramer, they say that it's completely encased, firmly fixed. So this indicates the process of implantation. Now we have the next stage, which is alaqa. Alaqa, according to the classical dictionaries and the dictionaries of Edwin Lane's Lexicon, which is an academic corpus, 8 volumes, it indicates that alaqa means something that's hanging or suspended, a leech-like or worm-like substance, or something that's sticky because of the way it clings together. Now, interestingly, this actually describes the next stage of the development of the human embryo, because there are two processes that happen. You have the process of neurulation and the process of the longitudinal folding of the embryo. Neurulation is when the neural folds come together, and longitudinal folding is when the head and the tail are slightly brought together closer. The combination of these two processes around day 25 makes it look like a leech, to the point where you have embryologists and anatomists, for example, if you read Anatomy Demystified, they actually say that this embryo looks like a worm. And these, even like Keith Moore, for example, said it looks like a leech. Even P.Z. Myers, Professor P.Z. Myers from America, who is a biologist, a professor, and he's an active proponent against religion, he actually even described it in his blog as a worm. So it's in line with the description of what we know to be alaqa. But also the alaqa at this stage does look like something that is suspending or hanging, which is the other meaning for alaqa. For example, you see the embryo at this point. Okay, if you see the embryo at this point, it's connecting to this, which is called the connecting stalk. The connecting stalk. And to the point where Beverly Kramer, John Allen, the embryologist, they say that the connecting stalk acts as a thing to suspend the embryo. Uses the word, exact word for the meaning alaqa. So this is amazing. It's in line with modern phenomena, established reality. After that we have mudgha. Now mudgha in the classical tradition, in some Arab, the classical dictionary, other dictionaries, means a morsel of flesh, a chewed piece of meat, or something that the teeth have left their bite marks on. And what you see, after the alaqa process, you have the embryo looking something like this, and you have these things on the notochord. Okay? These are called sclerotomes, as a result of somite formation. Now the somites travel to the notochord, and they form sclerotomes, which is the precursors to things like the backbone, and they look like teeth marks. Just Google it, or go and buy a book. They look like teeth marks, like someone's bitten it. chop. Now, elsewhere in the Quran, the mudhaka stage refers to something that is formed and unformed. The Quran clarifies, meaning that mudhaka is when it's formed and unformed. And at this stage, it's quite true. And it's called the organogenetic period. Now, the organogenetic period is when the organs start to develop, but they're not fully yet formed. Amazing. Then we have idham. Idham is simply bone formation. And we know bones start to develop around the 6th, 7th week, where you have especially the development of the limb bones. And they are with regards to the cartilaginous models of the bones. After this, you have an amazing process which is called fakasona. Okay? Fakasona, which means, and then we clothe. Or kasona means to encase, to drape, to enline, to aggregate. And then it says the flesh. So then we clothe or encase, drape the flesh. Think about the process. Now what happens after the development of the idham, the cartilaginous models of the bones? You have the myoblast cells, which are precursor cells to muscle formation. They migrate distally and migrate themselves over the forming limb bones. Which is? And then we clothe, drape, encase, aggregate over the bones, the flesh itself. Now there's a contention that people say, and there are many contentions which we'll deal with if we have a Q&A. And one contention is, well, you know, the word lahma actually means flesh, it doesn't mean muscle. So it's incoherent. You should use the Arabic term adlat, which means muscle. But it's wrong. If we read the works, for example, by Beverly Kramer, John Allen, they say at this process, it's not only muscle that's being formed, but other connective tissue, like tendons. And that's what flesh is. It's not only muscle, but it's other connective tissue, like tendons. This is why if you have a nice shawarma, you know what shawarma is, yeah? A lot of Arabs in Manchester, yeah? And you have a bite, sometimes you have this funny cartilage thing, or this squiggly thing that gets stuck in your teeth, and if you leave it in there overnight without brushing your teeth, it'll be painful, yeah? It'll just fill up. You can see that I don't brush my teeth on that, right? So the point is, that's what happens. So we see that it's not a scientific miracle per se, but whatever is established reality that the Quran agrees with. So we ask ourselves the question, how on earth can it be a product of the 7th century? Because the understanding of embryology at the time was a Galenic and Aristotelian understanding. And the Quran doesn't emulate Galen or Aristotle's works on the development of human embryo. Because Galen had the absurd view that semen came from blood. And that the two semens meet, then mix with menstrual blood. Something the Quran doesn't mention. Also, Galen mentioned the Greek word spermados. Now, spermados in Greek, okay, spermatos in Greek now obviously means sperm, but in the 2nd century understanding, it meant semen with regards to its physical product, the whole of the semen. But the word nutfa is not a synonym for semen, because we already discussed it's from the mani, it's from the semen. Do you see? And it's an extract, it's not specific. But the genetic understanding was, it's just semen. So the two terms don't match. Also, Aristotle had bizarre views that only the semen was from the father, not from the mother. She had no responsibility for the genetic makeup, which is not in line with the Quranic or the prophetic traditions. Also, Aristotle had the bizarre view that the semen mixed with the menstrual blood. Menstrual blood is not mentioned in the Quran with regards to the development of the human embryo. Also, Aristotle had the bizarre view that depending where the embryo is, it will be a male or female. Now, you may say, well, the Prophet still copied him because it's impossible that he knew this stuff, and he still copied him, but he just threw away what was wrong. Oh, that's interesting. How the hell did he know what was wrong? That supports our perspective. If he knew what was right, and knew what was wrong, and threw out what was wrong and kept what was right, what does that say about his knowledge? Is it human? Or is it from the divine? Something to think about. So we spoke about the numerical consonants, we spoke about, the history, and we spoke about the natural phenomenon. Now let's talk about another perspective, how the Quran shook the world, is by its language. Now as we said, the challenge of the Quran, when the Quran says, وإن كنتم في ريب مما نزلنا على عبدنا فأتوا بسورة من مثله ودعوا شهداءكم من دون الله إن كنتم صادقين. This was a challenge, a linguistic challenge originally, because the Arabs in 7th century Arabia, they were the best at expressing themselves in the Arabic tongue. They were Arabic linguists par excellence. And we know this because many historians and scholars today and in the past, for example, Ibn Rushd, an Arab historian, he states that the Arabs at the time would celebrate on two things: when a boy was born and when a poet rose amongst them. Think about this. When a poet was born, brother, when a boy was born and a poet rose amongst them. Because there was a socialization of poetry, that poetry is an amazing thing. To express yourself is amazing. But the Quran came down and de-scoped the Arabic language. Who's seen the message? Who remembers Hind? Hind is actually the Greek actress. Do you know that lady? She's really Greek. And you remember Hind? What did she say when the Quran started to be revealed in that film? And the reason I'm mentioning this is because she summarizes it perfectly, yeah? What did she say when she's doing something with her clothes? Talking to her husband. Abu Sufyan. Abu Sufyan. What did she say? She goes, how can an idiot man come from a mountain and start blazing with poetry? Yeah? And that's the reality. An illiterate man, which was the Prophet Muhammad upon him be peace, he came and he de-scoped the Arabic language. Because the Quran challenged the best people placed to challenge the Quran. But they failed. And the reason they failed because of the inimitability of the Quran. It cannot be matched. And there's two main arguments. One argument is based on its eloquence. Its placement of words, the way it uses words to communicate. And the other one is unique literary, I'll abbreviate to lit, literary form. Now the Quran has been seen to be a sea of eloquence. For much more information in a very understandable way, please go and visit albayyinah.com from Sheikh Numa Ali Khan. Google him, YouTube him. He is an amazing phenomenon that brings the Quran to light with regards to its linguistic appreciation. But the eloquence of the Quran is maybe seen as a subjective argument, but if you're sensitive to Arabic language, you see that the Quran expresses itself in a way that not only heightens the communicative effect, but does so in a really unique way. And let me give you an example with the first two lines of the shortest chapter in the Quran. Now, the shortest chapter of the Quran is called Al-Kawthar, the abundance. And it goes like this. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Inna a'tainaka al-kawthar, fasalli li rabbika wanhar. Inna shani'aka huwal akthar. Verily, indeed, we have given you the abundance. Therefore, pray to your Lord and sacrifice. Indeed, the one who hates you is truly cut off. Doesn't sound very eloquent in the English language, does it? No matter how much I shout and scream, yes? It doesn't sound eloquent at all, because it's in English. But if we break down the Arabic here, we see how phenomenal this chapter is. Just the first two lines in a very crude way, because we don't have much time. Now this verse, these chapters were revealed to console the Prophet Muhammad upon him be peace, because they used to attack him and call him bad names. Like, you're cut off. Apatar means you're cut off. You have no lineage because his sons died at early age. And the Quran came down to console him. And he says, indeed, verily, we have given you the abundance. Now it starts with inna. Inna is the emphatic particle in Arabic that basically means unquestionably. Without a doubt, full stop, bang, shut up. Honestly, I'm trying to express it in a popular term. Imagine someone just giving you a big slap. Shut up, man! And you got nowhere to go because you know he was right. It's even worse when he's right, isn't it? Yeah, that's the impact of the Quran from this perspective. Inna. And then we have the personal pronoun we. Why does it use we? It's the singular plural almost for majesty that kings say, we shall. Yeah? It's been used in Old English as well, in European language. The Quran uses we, because we is for emphasis, ability, power, surety. We can. Because the Quran says, indeed, unquestionably, we have given you the abundance. So the next term here is atain. Now atain here, from the Arabic language perspective, is a very profound use of language. You have to search in the ocean of the Arabic language to find such a word. Because this word doesn't just mean to give. It means that the thing I'm giving you, I own. And the thing I'm giving you with my own hand. Just one word has these connotations. Which indicates that even more of a surety is definitely that we have given you the abundance. And then the first verse ends, Al-Kawthar. Which we know theologically means the river in paradise. But it comes from the triliteral stem, Ka-tha-ra. Which have words in Arabic such as Kathir and Akthar. Multiple, plentiful. So he's saying that God has given you multiple things. So look at the emphasis, the almost the exaggeration of the first chapter. Inna a'tainaka al-kawthar. Verily, we have given you something that we own, give you our own hand, the abundance. And look at the shift now. The second verse. Fasalli li rabbika wanhar. And therefore pray to your Lord and sacrifice. Now we have the third here, which is like a cohesive tie. Okay? Because it connects the first verse with the second verse. It's like so or therefore. Some Arabic scholars say this is sababi, which means it's causative. Meaning, you know what's going on in the first verse, therefore do this. So, فَصَلِّ لِرَبِّكَ وَنْهَرْ. Therefore pray to your Lord. The word is used here, Rabb. Different use of personal pronoun. Rabb. But in the beginning, in the first verse, what was used? We. And now it shifts to Rabb. So it was we, now it's shifted to Lord, which is best described as master or the one that nurtures you and loves you. Why is there a shift here? Now this shift in Arabic rhetoric is called iltifat, which basically means moving from one direction to the other. And it's done to enhance the communicative effect of the message, the dynamic style of the Quranic discourse, because we is aptly placed for ability and power we have given you. Your Lord is aptly placed for spirituality and intimacy. For suddenly your Rabbika wanhar. Do you see the shift? In the correct context. The first line is for power and ability. The second line is for intimacy and prayer. Do you catch the drift, brothers? Show me some emotion. There's a Greek saying, it's a Greek scenario. Synodality basically means you could like, you know, you have no pathos, no bathos, yeah? Anyway, I'm getting all hyped up by this by myself, yeah? It's like therapy for me. It's so amazing, man. And I was like, it's like being in Malaysia again. No offense. No, there's a context to this. I had a tour in Malaysia, and as a culture generally, and they would agree with this, seldom do they express their emotion, yeah? I remember once I was giving like really passionate talk. Hey, you must do this! Oh, we're gonna do that! And blah blah blah! And they're like, like, what happened to you guys, man? Now, you need to best at poker! You know? The stakes are high, yeah? And after, but they're very good at writing. So on Facebook, they'll be like, oh, Hamza, that was great. I loved it so much. I was so in tears. I'm like, where were you, man? But yeah, I mean, but also on a positive note, the Malaysian culture, the Malays are very, very, very soft-hearted, have good adab, which in Arabic means good akhlaq, good manners, good disposition, and very, very friendly people, and any opportunity to eat. Honestly, I was in an interview once and they gave me food. I came out of the interview, they give you food. You wake up for prayer, you have food. Like, wow, how do they stay so slim? It must be that fruit that they have. It's called durian. Now durian is called the king of fruits. And if you eat it for the first time, it's like eating from a toilet. And they say you eat it 5 times and you're addicted. I had it once. And then it was like there was a toilet in my stomach. It's like really smelly, fleshy. It's massive, fleshy fruit. Anyway. That's off the topic, yeah? So, where were we? Yes, so the Quran has this eloquence. So the eloquence of the Quran de-scopes any other type of Arabic because you can't match it with regard to its eloquence. Because Surah Al-Kawthar is only 10 words long, but there are 20 rhetorical and eloquent features within it, unknown in any other text. Now there's more of an objective argument, which is the second argument, is the unique literary form of the Quran. Now, in the Arabic language, you have certain forms, okay? And these forms are prose and poetry. Now, prose has two further styles, generally speaking, called rhyme prose, or saja, and normal speech, which is called mursal. And the poetry has to adhere to 16 rhythmical patterns, and they're called the al-bihar. Okay? Now, with regards to rhyme prose, it also has its own rhythmical pattern, but it's not based on syllables. This is a syllabic rhythmical pattern, syllabic, and this is accent-based rhythmical pattern. There's a big difference. That's based on the length of syllables, that's based on the accent. Let me give an example. Ba ba, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir. You control the masses. You do that for your nursery. Yeah, so. And also, rhyme prose has further other technical features, but I don't want to bore you to death, okay? You're already getting there, so let me just stop, yeah? But the point is, the Quran doesn't fit into any of these forms. It has de-scoped the Arabic language. But when you express yourself in the Arabic language, you're always going to express yourself in a poetic form, in accordance with rhythmical patterns, in normal prose, or in rhyme prose. But the Quran de-scoped the Arabic language as a unique literary form. This is why A.J. Arbery, the famous translator of the Quran that's still used today by academics, said the Quran is a unique fusion of prose and poetry. This is why you have Bruce Lawrence, Professor Bruce Lawrence, from Duke University, in his book, The Quran, a biography, on page number 8, he says, as tangible signs, Quranic verses are expressive of inexhaustible truth. They signify meaning, laid within meaning, light upon light, miracle after miracle. Professor Martin Zamek from the Netherlands, he says the Quran is the most eminent written manifestation of the Arabic language. So we're saying, how can a literate man in the 7th century bring, without any development or cultivation of eloquence, because he never engaged as a poet, he never got involved in the fairs when you had basically debates on who's the best on eloquence and poetry, then where did it come from? How can it be just from a man, since it de-scoped the Arabic language? And the Arabic language is only made up of a finite set of tools, 28 words, finite grammatical rules, finite words. So it's finite. And when we exhaust them, we cannot produce the Quran. So this is almost like an act of impossibility. It transcends its own tools. If I gave you any blueprint and said, here's Monet, what was he, a post-impressionist? Whatever, in art, yeah, he was something, yeah? And I gave you the skills, and I gave you the tools, and the brushstrokes, and the materials, and said, copy his work, you would copy his form. But we've got the blueprint of the Quran today and the tools available, and we can't do that. It is no wonder the famous Arabist of the time, Walid ibn al-Mughira, said, this is not from a human being. And it is no wonder that Professor Arbuthnot, he says, although several attempts have been made to challenge the Quran, none have yet succeeded. So to conclude in the last few minutes, brothers and sisters, the Quran shook the world because of its content, because of its miracle. It engaged people to think, but also the Quran, brothers and sisters, changed the world because of its message. Its message was profound. It was one of Tawheed, meaning affirm the oneness of God. You know what I spoke about slavery in the beginning? You're a slave to yourself, you're a slave to society or political context, or you're a slave to the divine. This is what the Quran is telling you. Affirming the oneness of God, of Allah, is actually the message of the Quran. It's the central pillar of the Quran, the message of all the prophets. Don't actually be partners with the divine. Don't say that he is like a human being. Don't engage in anthropomorphic activity and conceptualization. He is transcendent. He is the divine. And this is why the Quran came to say, look, worship is not a requirement for God. God doesn't need our worship. He's al-ghani, he's rich, he's free, he's independent. We need it. This is how we're going to survive in this world and have a tranquil life, regardless of context. And we're going to have a tranquil life in the Akhirah, because there are two realities, people, which we believe in, Muslims do. It's hell and heaven. As God is saying, you choose. I'm not forcing you to do anything, but it's your choice. and the Quran gives you good reasons to believe in it, gives you a choice, and says, I want to free you from the ephemeral nature of the world, so you could have ubudiyya, servanthood with the divine, so you could love the divine and get close to the divine via affirming his oneness. And finally, the Quran shook the world, brothers and sisters and friends, because it developed Western civilization. You think it's funny? It's actually true. The Quran gave us the presumption of innocence. The Quran gave us scientific progression, the Renaissance. And the Quran gave us treaties of tolerance. Let me prove this to you, not by using a mad mullah, by using Western historians. You could go into a court, brothers and sisters, and stand in a court and say, that wasn't my weed. Yeah? You could say that. You could presume yourself to be innocent. That's not my weed. That, and also the other thing, that was just talcum powder, right? You could say those things in a court. You could say those things in a court of law because you presume to be innocent before you prove guilty. This was developed as a result of the Islamic tradition. The Quran gave us the principles to have the presumption of innocence in the 7th century. Before King Louis, who developed this for the West, in order to be not guilty, you have to fight a duel or get burnt alive. If you survive, you're not guilty. So everyone was guilty, basically. Now King Louis traveled to the East, he met a monk, the monk read the Quran, he also read the prophetic teachings, and the monk gave him, word for word, the prophetic teaching of the Prophet Muhammad upon him be peace. King Louis, this is in Wikipedia, guys. It's also in historical textbooks. And if you want to be a bit more academic, go to Marcel Boissard's article in the 1980s called The Probable Influence of Islam on the Presumption of Innocence. And he talks about King Louis. And Jean de Ville, he was the chronicler who wrote about King Louis. And Jean de Ville elaborates on these points that the West took the most important legal maxim from the Quran, from the Muslims. Believe it or not. And they say Sharia law is bad. If you don't like Sharia law, you don't like your law from that perspective. So Islam is not an enemy, it's not a foe, it's a friend. Second point, Renaissance. Who's got an iPhone? Blackberry, Crackberry. We have phones, watches, cars, computers. These all happened as a result of Islam. Why? Because Islam, with regards to its principles of justice in the Quran and the principles of dealing with minorities, created the tranquility, a political environment that was tranquil. As Adam Smith, if you look behind your £20 note, is Adam Smith. He's the 18th century founder of modern capitalist economics. And he basically said that the empire of the caliphs, the empire of Islam, developed that tranquility so people, Muslim and non-Muslim, could really engage into the interconnecting principles of nature to develop these sciences. Now, Islamic Spain was the hub of that. Now, when Islamic Spain was taken over by the Christians again, particularly Toledo, you had European scholars traveling to Toledo, and they found libraries, and they found Arabic works on astronomy, physics, mathematics, geology, science. And they said, wow. And they translated it into Latin, and they translated it into English. And as Professor Thomas Arnold, the Arabist and historian, he says, if it wasn't for Islamic Spain, we wouldn't have the 15th and 16th century scientific revolution as a result of that environment that the Quran created as a result of its political principles. So the Renaissance is as a result of Islam. Not 100%, but a very key part. And it is no wonder Adelard of Bath and Daniel of Morley, the English scholars, they travelled to Toledo, picked up the manuscripts, and they went back to where? Oxford. And what did they create? Oxford University. Imagine that. The basis of Oxford University is as a result of Islam. What about treaties of tolerance? Read the works by Christopher J. Walker in his book Islam and History. He states that John Locke, who wrote the works on civil governance, and he influenced the Constitution, the American Constitution, influenced the founding fathers of America, and he also wrote treaties on tolerance. He was influenced as a result of Islamic learning, because his teacher was who? Edward Pocock, the first Orientalist in the 17th century. He was the man who traveled to the East, I believe in Palestine and elsewhere, and took Islamic manuscripts on these issues. And John Locke, in his own words, says that there's no other man I'd like to sit in and listen to other than Edward Pocock. And he was what? The head of Islamic studies at Oxford University in the 17th century. And he directly influenced John Locke. And if you read on civil governance, he says that rulership is a divine trust, a vicegerency. Someone translate vicegerency for me in Arabic.
Khilafah.
Khilafah, which is the sultanate, the caliphate. He took the stuff from the Muslims. So Islam shook the world, and it shakes your world today when you go to court. It shakes the world when you pick up the phone because of the technology, the scientific progression. And it shakes the world because you all can sit here in this room and be from different traditions and talk together. Islam had that influence. The Quran shook the world from this perspective. Thank you very much for listening.